It is a fact that the body of water off the coast of Louisiana is called the Gulf of America. And I'm not sure why news outlets don't want to call it that, but that is what it is.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's just a fact. Everyone knows that.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding, on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico, or is that New America, on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADRM, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and we're available on most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Now, in our 22nd year of troublemaking and muckraking, and boy, am I exhausted. Anyway, welcome... Welcome to the Bradcast. Coming up shortly, yes, we will talk about Donald Trump's dumb name change of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. And it's frankly, it's one of those things that we haven't spent much time on over the tumultuous and chaotic first month of Donald Trump's second tumultuous and chaotic term in office, because frankly, there is just so much else going on that seems far more important and perilous. But I do have a good reason to talk about it today, and I will be joined by a guest to do so shortly. Also, speaking of important and perilous, Desi Doyen will have our latest Green News Report a little bit later this hour.
Am I important and perilous, well, or is the GNR important and
well,
perilous?
Well, actually both, now that you mention it. That's going to be a little bit later this hour, as the Trump administration is really working really hard to make things much more dangerous for all Americans and the world, it seems to me. Nonetheless, the peril hardly stops there. The Republican-controlled Senate on Thursday confirmed longtime henchman and MAGA marketer Kash Patel as director of the FBI in a narrow 51-49 vote in the Senate on Thursday, despite his obvious loyalty to President Donald Trump's retribution agenda and lingering questions about whether he perjured himself during his confirmation hearings. All Democrats voted against Patel, I'm happy to say, and they were joined by only two Republicans, Senators Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the two that you might guess. But they were the only Republican senators to oppose Patel's confirmation to a 10-year post as FBI director. I don't think a lot of people understand that. I think they maybe assume that the FBI director is, you know, like all of the other cabinet appointees, he'll serve as long as the president is in power, etc. But no, it's actually a 10-year post as FBI director, which is long enough that it's supposed to ensure that FBI directors are not just partisan political hacks, political appointees, but rather appointees who will span across several presidential terms, potentially of different parties. Of course, To avoid that, to have anybody who doesn't serve his partisan political agenda in the role, Donald Trump simply fires whoever is the FBI director when he takes office, and he appoints someone who he thinks will be a good partisan stooge for him. For the record, since the establishment of the FBI, every single director has been a Republican.
Yeah, let's say that again, just to make sure everybody in the back heard it, too. Every single FBI director has been a Republican. And why is that?
Well, other than that, you know, it's a totally liberal institution. Yeah, it's got to be torn down, as both Cash Patel and Donald Trump have insisted over the years. Mainly because, you know, the FBI keeps noticing that Donald Trump keeps violating the laws and stuff. In a statement ahead of the final vote, Senator Collins said, quote, "There is a compelling need for an FBI director who is decidedly apolitical, which is decidedly not Cash Patel." Now that he's confirmed, as TPM's Kaya Himmelman notes, Patel is expected to take on the task of carrying out Trump's own personal retribution agenda. He has publicly threatened to go after Trump's perceived enemies, and he even included in his 2023 book called Government Gangsters the names of close to 60, quote, members of the executive branch deep state who he claims are a, quote, dangerous threat to democracy. Because, you know, Trump and Patel are very concerned about democracy. Patel, during his confirmation hearing last month, claimed that this list was not actually an enemies list. It was simply a glossary in the book, so people would know who he was referring to when he said people like Hillary Clinton. You know, who? Never heard of her. Oh, let's go check the appendix at the back of the book, the glossary, which included names from former U.S. presidents to top Pentagon generals to even Trump's former attorney general and national security advisors. During his confirmation hearings, Patel called his so-called enemies list a, quote, total mischaracterization, despite his own public remarks to the contrary. During an interview with Steve Bannon, for example, just last year, last December, Patel said that he would not only go after, quote, conspirators that he believed were in the government, in the deep state, but that he would also go after conspirators in the media who, in his words, quote, helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections.
We will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. Yes, we're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you, whether it's criminally or civilly. We'll figure that out. But yeah, we're putting you all on notice. And this is why they hate us. This is why we're tyrannical. This is why we're dictators.
Actually, there's a lot more reasons why they hate you, and, you know, give yourself more credit, Cash. It's just one of the reasons that you are dictators, but it is a good one because, you know, dictators do, as one of their first orders of business, start going against media outlets that they do not like, coming against media. Now, by the way, even if the media did lie about, immigrants, or lie about rigging the election, for which there is no evidence that the election, presumably he's talking about the 2020 election, that that was rigged by the media or anyone else. But if the media does lie, they are allowed to do so under the First Amendment, freedom of the press. Just take a look at Fox News. That's how they've made their tens of millions of dollars over the years, by lying to chumps and suckers and dupes that Cash Patel then, you know, takes their money as well. But that's what they do. That's what dictators do. They shut down media outlets that they do not like. They go after them. They take them on, whether it's civilly or criminally. We'll figure that out, he says. Media outlets that they can't control. And they, yeah, start shutting them down if they can figure out how to get away with it. Totally coincidentally, by the way, on page 247 of Project 2025, one of the broadcast's main syndication networks, the Pacifica Network, is mentioned by name as one of the media outlets to be targeted by the Trump administration. Of course, Trump said during the campaign that he didn't know nothing about what? Project 2025? Never heard of it, even though most of its authors were former Trump officials, staffers, and about two-thirds of the stuff that he has done since taking office a second time appears to be ripped straight out of Project 2025, that according to several analyses. But of course, we don't have to guess about the attacks on the media by the Trump administration, because Trump's FCC chair, as we previously reported, has already recommended that NPR and PBS have their educational broadcast licenses removed, claiming that they are operating not as educational broadcast sources, but as commercial for-profit entities. Because you know all that money that NPR and PBS bring in. Or something. This is a recommendation that no chair of the Federal Communications Commission has ever made for any media outlet, but now Donald Trump's new chair of the FCC has done exactly that. More on the looming threats to the media and our First Amendment rights in a moment. But as Republicans have consistently rallied around Patel, congressional Democrats have rallied against his nomination, thankfully, for what it's worth, arguing that if confirmed, Patel would use his position to target Trump's perceived political enemies, not just in the media, but of all stripes, since, of course, that is what Patel has blatantly said that he would do. Here was Rhode Island's Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse on Thursday morning in front of the FBI building that Patel had vowed to shut down on day one and turn it into a museum of the deep state on day two. We'll see what happens tomorrow in that regard. But here's Whitehouse in front of the FBI building in advance of Patel's confirmation vote on the floor of the U.S. Senate on Thursday.
When left to his own devices, Kash Patel has proven himself to be a wildly vindictive partisan. When around Donald Trump, Kash Patel has proved himself to be a sycophantic suck-up. He has multiple foreign entanglements that are not adequately explained, including Chinese interests through Cayman Islands shell corporations. This from a guy who in this building is supposed to look out against China and Russia. And last, this is the first senior law enforcement official in American history to have pled the fifth, and he has been unwilling to even explain to the Judiciary Committee what crimes it was that he was concerned about that caused him to plead the fifth. Kash Patel, mark my words, will cause evil in this building behind us, and Republicans who vote for him will rue that day.
Well, we will see, but it is interesting to have an FBI director who had to plead the fifth himself. A plea of the fifth means that you might implicate yourself in a crime, which you are not required to do. You have protections against that under the U.S. Constitution. Not that Patel gives much of a damn, or the Trump administration gives much of a damn about the Constitution, at least until, you know, they need it to protect themselves from testifying against themselves regarding a crime. What crime? We don't know.
Sounds awfully blackmailable.
Sure does, doesn't it? For a sycophantic suck-up, as he called him. By the way, not mentioned in that clip is the report from just a week or two ago that Patel was paid $25,000 for his participation in a series of propaganda videos attacking the FBI, produced by a man who has long worked with Russia to produce Russian propaganda videos. But really, an FBI director tasked with investigating, you know, Russian and other foreign influence schemes in the U.S., taking money from Russian sources, even that is not enough to vote against the guy for a 10-year term as FBI director? Really, Republicans? Well, apparently, really. But of course, there is more, much more. Last week, Senate Judiciary Committee ranking member Dick Durbin of Illinois, Democrat, brought forth evidence to support his claim that Patel was personally involved in a, quote, purge of senior law enforcement officials within the Bureau before being confirmed. In a letter to DOJ Inspector General Michael Horowitz this month, Durbin described, quote, highly credible information from multiple sources suggesting that Patel had been involved in multiple firings at the FBI before he was confirmed, and that if the allegations are true, Patel may have perjured himself about that during his Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. Well, that's another good start for the new FBI director. Perjury. So perjury, claiming the fifth, being paid by foreign adversaries of the U.S., perfect dude to become FBI director. According to Dick Durbin, whistleblowers revealed to him that Patel, working in conjunction with White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller and Trump's personal defense attorney, now turned acting Deputy Attorney General at the Department of Justice, Emil Bovee, and members of the FBI Director Advisory Team, dismissed senior law enforcement officials at the FBI as part of an early purge of senior DOJ staff who worked on Trump's two criminal prosecutions, as well as agents and lawyers involved in charging January 6 defendants who have all since been pardoned by Donald Trump, despite many of them having violently attacked law enforcement officials that day in a, yes, armed attack at the U.S. Capitol. I'm having trouble even going through this again in my brain, hearing myself say it.
It's all so absurd. It seems unreal.
The dismissals were understood to be retaliatory and an act of political retribution on behalf of Trump. But even if they were not unlawful in that way, the fact that Patel said he knew nothing about him, he had nothing to do with it during his confirmation hearing when he's under oath, well, yeah, that would be perjury. According to reporting from the New York Times, at least nine officials have been fired from the FBI since the start of Trump's presidency. And even though Patel claimed to the Senate Judiciary Committee he had nothing to do with that, well, apparently its ranking Democratic leader, Senator Durbin, suggests otherwise and appears to have provided the receipts to the inspector general, one of the few that was not fired by Donald Trump. So we'll see how that goes. But beyond that, even if Kash Patel did commit perjury, who's going to investigate that? Kash Patel's FBI? That's the insane criminal feedback loop that we are now in, that we are all now stuck in and trying to figure out how to get out of. As to Patel targeting media and the broader Trump administration's sort of overt assault on the press and its First Amendment free speech rights, here was CNN's Caitlin Collins last week asking Trump's 27-year-old White House press secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, about the White House decision last week to bar the Associated Press from press events at the White House because the AP explained, as an international news agency, they would continue to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of Mexico rather than the Gulf of America, as the White House is insisting they must, at least if they want to be allowed to cover White House press events.
Which White House official made the decision to bar the AP reporter from the Oval Office and the diplomatic reception room last night?
Well, first of all, let me just set the record straight. It is a privilege to cover this White House. It's a privilege to be the White House press secretary. And nobody has the right to go into the Oval Office and ask the President of the United States questions. That's an invitation that is given. We reserve the right to decide who gets to go into the Oval Office.
But isn't it retaliatory in nature is the argument, because the reason that the AP was barred, which they said was because they're not using the phrase Gulf of America, they're using Gulf of Mexico in line with their standards. And so the question here is this setting a precedent that this White House will retaliate against reporters who don't use the language that you guys believe reporters should use? And how does that align with the First Amendment commitment that you were just talking about?
I was very upfront in my briefing on day one that if we feel that there are lies being pushed by outlets in this room, we are going to hold those lies accountable. And it is a fact that the body of water off the coast of Louisiana is called the Gulf of America. And I'm not sure why news outlets don't want to call it that, but that is what it is. The Secretary of Interior has made that the official designation in the geographical identification name server, and Apple has recognized that, Google has recognized that, pretty much every other outlet in this room has recognized that body of water as the Gulf of America, and it's very important to this administration that we get that right, not just for people here at home, but also for the rest of the world. Sure.
Yes, it's very important that we get that right for both people here at home and in the rest of the world who might be confused about the real name of the Gulf of America. What is this Gulf of Mexico that the AP is referring to in their story? I'm very confused. I've never heard of it. But is it very important? Or perhaps a better question is it even more important than the First Amendment of our Constitution and its bedrock protections of freedom of the press? And a question for all of us, given so much that is going on right now, is it worth standing our ground for that particular fight, a seemingly petty and inconsequential one, at least if you don't count that whole First Amendment part? And finally, who gets to decide what is worth fighting for and what is not worth fighting for in the Trump era? I've got just the person to ask about all of those points, and he joins us next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
When I get off of this mountain, you know where I wanna go.
Where?
Straight down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of Mexico.
Gulf of what?
To Lake Charles, Louisiana. Little Bessie girl I once knew. And she told me just to come on by if there's anything that she could do. Up on Cripple Creek.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. We will explain this use of this particular bumper music momentarily. As regular listeners of the Bradcast likely know by now, because I sort of talk about it almost every day, I struggle each day in the Trump era to figure out what is worth covering and what is not. There are all sorts of various criteria that go into that decision-making each day, but in the end, it's some combination of my best guess of what I think you need to know and or understand, or what I can add something to and or what isn't getting the coverage elsewhere that I think it merits. I may get it wrong, I may get it right. In truth, I don't think any of us in the media yet understand how to correctly cover this era, but hopefully we, at least here at the Bradcast, get it right more often than we get it wrong. There is another way to look at all of this, as some politicos and media pundits have, which is, what fights are worth picking? Ultimately, in the Trump era, reporting becomes an argument as to what we in the media feel is the most important thing that Americans need to know, or at least it should be. But for activists and politicians, particularly Democrats these days, the question is, which fight can we win that makes it somehow worth picking that fight? A week or so ago, we reported on an explanation from the Associated Press of how they planned to cover Donald Trump's apparently unilateral decision via executive order upon taking office to declare that he was renaming the continent's tallest mountain peak up in Alaska to Mount McKinley once again, named for a U.S. president that never stepped foot in Alaska, but never mind that. That came following the following then President Barack Obama back in 2015, changing the name from Mount McKinley to Denali, the name that it had been used by Alaskan natives for some 10,000 years or so. Alaskans, including the state's two Republican senators, opposed the renaming of Denali back to Mount McKinley. But of course, Trump doesn't care. The black president changed it to Denali, so he was going to change it back. Whatever. And apparently, after that executive order was signed by Trump, as AP explained in an announcement regarding their style guide as relied upon by international media outlets around the world, quote, the Associated Press will use the official name change to Mount McKinley. The area lies solely in the U.S., and as president, Donald Trump has the authority to change federal geographical names within the country. But as to Trump's declaration that the Gulf of Mexico would now be known as the Gulf of America, well, AP also noted in their announcement, quote, the body of water has shared borders between the U.S. and Mexico. Trump's order only carries authority within the United States. Mexico, as well as other countries and international bodies, do not have to recognize the name change. The outlet observes that the Gulf of Mexico has carried that name for more than 400 years. The Associated Press will refer to it by its original name while acknowledging the new name that Trump has chosen. As a global news agency, they write, that disseminates news around the world, the AP must ensure that place names and geography are easily recognizable to all audiences. Before going on to cite other such location names like the Gulf of California, which is sometimes referred to as the Sea of Cortez, the U.S. government has designated that body of water as the Gulf of California, while Mexico recognizes it as the Sea of Cortez. Now, none of that seemed particularly important, and we wouldn't have bothered to cover any of it on this show had it not been for what the Trump administration did next. They subsequently banned the AP from Oval Office events and Air Force One, etc., unless and until they officially agreed to call the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. At that point, as AP noted in another announcement, quote, it is alarming that the Trump administration would punish AP for its independent journalism, limiting our access to the Oval Office based on the content of AP's speech. Not only severely impedes the public's access to independent news, it plainly violates the First Amendment. Well, that suddenly seems important, doesn't it? Well, not to Gilad Edelman, the senior editor at The Atlantic, apparently, who argues that the Gulf of America is the wrong fight to pick, writing and seemingly blaming the victim here that, quote, this is a fight that Trump is clearly happy to have, especially to the extent that it draws attention away from his more egregious affronts to the public interest and the rule of law. And it's a fight that the AP probably should never have picked in the first place, which kind of feels like Trump blaming Ukraine this week for Russia having invaded them. Did AP pick that fight by following and explaining their style guide usage of place names that they and many news outlets have followed for decades and decades? Is the First Amendment not an important fight for one of the world's largest and most important media outlets to pick? Writes Edelman, quote, a huge share of Trump's actions over the past 4 weeks fall somewhere on the spectrum from legally questionable to plainly unconstitutional. The Gulf of America rebrand is not one of them. A federal law passed in 1890 and updated in 1947 empowers the U.S. Board on Geographic Names to standardize how the federal government refers to places. The board answers to the Secretary of the Interior, who answers to the president. That's the same legal authority under which the Obama administration changed the name Mount McKinley to Denali. Okay, but that sort of does not speak to either the international aspects of the name change or, far more importantly, the First Amendment issues at stake here. Nor why the senior editor at The Atlantic, for crying out loud, doesn't seem to believe that that is worth fighting for. Longtime media critic and political strategist Jameson Fowser, however, responding to Edelman's piece, seems to think that it is worth fighting for, or at least it's not Edelman's position to decide what anyone else should or should not fight for in the Trump era. The dumbest part, observes Fozer in his latest piece this week, is that Edelman concludes his argument by noting, quote, Trump controls the Department of the Interior, but not the English language. The American people can decide for themselves whether to go with the Gulf of Mexico or the Gulf of America, which, of course, is all the Associated Press did, decide for itself. So what are we even doing here, asks Fozer. Why did The Atlantic inflict upon its readers a piece whose conclusion repudiates its publication? Those are some good questions from Fozer, who asked them before raising an even larger point. Who is Edelman and The Atlantic to decide what fight is or isn't important to anyone to pick, even if, as noted, AP didn't actually pick this fight at all? Joining us now for the first time in way too many years is Jameson Fozer, who has 30 years of experience in national politics as a political strategist, media critic, and writer. He also helped create the indispensable nonprofit media watchdog Media Matters for America, where he served for years as executive vice president. He's now the author of the Finding Gravity newsletter, where we wish him luck in exactly that. Jameson Fozer, thank you, sir, for joining us today on the broadcast. I know you're under the weather, so really appreciate it today in particular.
Thank you so much for having me, Brad.
So your piece, your response to Edelman, and the larger picture of the question of what fights to pick in the Trump era kind of struck a chord with me, as maybe you can tell, for a number of reasons. But first, focusing on just the Gulf of Mexico, the so-called fight, why is that a fight worth picking as you see it?
I mean, I actually come at this from a little bit different perspective, which is right now, I think the nature of the situation that we're in and the breadth and depth of the ways that we're in trouble and things are stacked against us. And an autocratic movement has control of our entire government, much of the news media, much of the ways that people get information online. Things are really stacked against us. We're not in a situation in which there are obvious, clear, easily discernible, winnable fights that we can choose. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that, you know, people should only choose, you know, fights that they can win, I actually think people should choose the fights that feel right to them in the moment and that they can get something out of. And we should all be doing a little less trying to police what fights other people are choosing to engage in, and more just finding a place we can stand up and pick a fight where we can. And we will probably lose it, because we will probably lose most of them. Mm-hmm. But sometimes in the loss, there's some value. And in this one, there's some value. There's some value in saying, look, we can't stop Donald Trump from ordering his government to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. Mm-hmm. But we can say we're not going along with that. It is racist and dumb, and he can't make us say it.
Right.
And there's value in saying that to ourselves, in not giving in to his control of the English language or his attempt to. And there's value in showing our fellow, our fellow Americans that we're not going along with that, and that there can be some solidarity in that I think is really valuable, again, kind of particularly for the people who are the targets of what, again, is this very racist move. He's not trying to rename the Gulf of Mexico by accident. It's specifically because it's the Gulf of Mexico that he's chosen it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that in general. Actually, I agree with that in whole, but there is, and I want to talk more about that in a second, but there is really some very specific First Amendment implications here. You know, this comes on a day that Trump loyalist and MAGA merchandiser Cash Patel has been confirmed as the new director of the FBI after recently declaring he would go after media outlets that he didn't like. So here you have the Associated Press saying, look, we know it's a simple thing. You're locking us out of the Oval Office because you don't like what we said, but that's actually a First Amendment issue that kind of seems like it needs to be stood up for here. And I don't know. I was kind of surprised that the senior editor of The Atlantic didn't even seem to address that.
Yeah, he seemed pretty confused overall about what his position even was. I mean, as you noted, he concluded his piece by acknowledging that Donald Trump doesn't control the English language and people can decide for themselves what to call the Gulf of Mexico. That's all the Associated Press did.
Right.
And so Donald Trump and his administration trying to respond to that by punishing the Associated Press for doing nothing more than calling the Gulf of Mexico what it has always been called, mm-hmm. is pretty outrageous. You know, Trump's renaming of the Gulf of Mexico only applies to how the government refers to it. Mm-hmm. He has no legal authority to mandate how the rest of us talk about it, including the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. So there clearly is a First Amendment issue there and a freedom of speech issue. And yes, I take your point that it is bizarre for a member of the news media writing in The Atlantic to say that that's something that's not worth standing up for.
And let me go a little bit further there. The White House Correspondents Association, as far as I know, some of us have called for them to, again, not the great largest issue in the world, but I think it, you know, if you let this one go, there's a lot more coming. So, I've called for the White House Correspondents Association to back up AP in this fight. Some have called for them to, have their affiliates boycott White House press avails in response until AP is allowed back into the room. If they have done that, I haven't heard about it. Should they? And if they have not, why wouldn't they?
My understanding and all I know is from what I've read in some of the reporting, but mm-hmm. is that they're trying to work behind the scenes to push back on this, thinking that if they pick the Correspondents Association, that is, if they pick a very public fight over this, the Trump administration will only harden its position. But if they can perhaps behind the scenes negotiate some sort of satisfying resolution, that might be the best outcome. I'm willing to defer to their judgment on that. They know better than I do what conversations they're having. But to go back to a point you made a minute ago, about what happens if we back down on this, I think that actually is a really good argument for standing firm on things like mm-hmm. this. Like, this is a relatively low stakes fight in relative to some of the other things this administration is mm-hmm. going to do, like illegally deporting people, mm-hmm. illegally harassing people via the IRS.
Right.
What happens if the Trump administration sees that people won't take even a low effort, yep. low consequence stand against their dumbest and most unnecessary actions? That's just an invitation to roll over us on mm-hmm. everything else. This is literally just a matter of people using the phrase Gulf of Mexico.
I don't even understand why this is an issue, but it is. You cite Jamel Bowie from the New York Times posting over at Blue Sky. He says, my take is that your willingness to accept this Gulf of America nonsense is an indicator of your willingness to accept much worse things coming from this administration. And I think that's a smart take, actually.
Yeah, I think we should not generally be in the business of signaling to this administration that we will go along with things, even when it's easy to not go along with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's easy to not go along with. You're just saying Gulf of Mexico.
And it's, there's a bigger fight, obviously, as you highlight, and in the other folks deciding for anyone else what they think is a fight worth picking. You mention at the top of your piece on all of this that it actually does have resonance with Americans, as you explained with an anecdote at the top of the piece about a concert that you went to last week. Tell me what happened there and how it underscores your argument here, because clearly this matter did mean a whole lot, it seems, to the folks that were at that concert with you last week.
Yeah, and I think this is why that Atlantic piece, when I saw it this week, made me so angry. So last week, I was in Athens, Georgia, for one of the Drive-By Truckers, a band called the Drive-By Truckers, has an annual weekend in Athens where they have some homecoming concerts. And I was there for that. And when the band walked on stage one night, they started things off with Patterson Hood, co-founder of the band, reciting the opening lines of the band's Up on Cripple Creek, mm-hmm. which begins, "When I get off of this mountain, I'll tell you where I'm going to go, straight down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of," and he stopped. And he left the last word for the audience to fill in. And the audience shouted out, "Mexico." And then he repeated, "Straight down the Mississippi River to the Gulf of," and we shouted again, louder, "Mexico." And then a third time. And it was the most cathartic moment I've experienced in the last 3 months.
Right.
There was a few hundred people, many of them middle-aged white people, many of them from the deep South, collectively, spontaneously, defiantly, joyously expressing a refusal to go along with some racist BS from a would-be autocrat.
Uh-huh.
And there's value in that. There's value in that, again, for each of us individually. There was value of that for us collectively, seeing we're not alone. There are other people who won't go along with mm-hmm. this. And I think that's a valuable thing. It's not going to change government policy, but we're in for a long fight here. And those moments of hope, those moments of resilience, those moments of resistance that we can have for ourselves and for each other have value.
A long fight and a lot of fights, as you said earlier. And I'm of the mind, and from what I can tell from your piece this week, you seem to be of a similar mind, that there is basically enough to go around for all of us to fight when and if we want to or feel that we need to, and that second guessing someone else's fight is both pathetic and ultimately wildly unhelpful. Am I reading that right?
You are, and I'll add just, you know, to that point, Edelman in his piece in The Atlantic argues that this is a distraction from more important things. Well, the only person I know of who's distracted here is Edelman, uh-huh. right? Like, the Associated Press just made an announcement of what they're going to do. This guy is an editor for The Atlantic. This is only the second piece he's written since Donald Trump was elected in November. Uh-huh. The first one was about light bulbs. So, like, I don't think he's exactly laser focused on the deeper matters of lawbreaking that are going on. He devoted one piece to LED light bulbs and one piece to whining that the Associated Press is going to use the phrase Gulf of Mexico. Like, if anybody's distracted here, that's the guy. And that's usually what we see when we see somebody say, oh, don't get distracted from the real fight. Like, the person who's most distracted is the person spending their time policing what other people are worried about.
Yes. Yeah. And it's really not a new problem, Jameson Fosser. At its core, at least in the media, it's sort of a school of commentary that had kind of annoyed me for years. You know, never mind this issue that everyone's talking about. Here's the real problem we need to be focusing on. I hate that, which is
because right. And so fine, do it.
Yeah. And it's essentially tearing down someone else's work to somehow prop up your own. I'm not going to name names, but I've seen that a lot over the years from certain quarters in the media.
Right. And yeah, and my reaction is almost always there. If you think we should focus on something else, focus on
it. Yes. And I've been particularly galled by various commentary from some folks, theoretically on the left. Bill Maher comes to mind, but others have as well. Others as well, that, you know, we shouldn't fight for certain things. DEI, which is really the GOP code word for, you know, anti-discrimination efforts, or for trans rights, because, oh, that's a losing issue politically. There's so few trans kids out there. It costs us too much to fight for them. Well, fine. If you feel that way, don't wage those fights. But for those who see it as important, get the F out of the way and let them fight. No?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what this isn't a fight worth waging often translates as is this isn't something that affects me.
Yeah. Yep. I think you're absolutely right on that. You write this week at your Finding Gravity newsletter site, quote, "We aren't in a situation in which we can pick only the right fights, only fights we can clearly win. Things are much worse than that and will be for a long time. The truth is there aren't many fights that we can have a degree of confidence we can win. There's too much stacked against us. We have to be willing to pick some fights we'll probably lose because those are pretty much the only kind of fights we have." Elected Democratic political leaders have come under some fire for their, particularly early on, their pronouncements that they had to pick and choose only the fights that they think they can win, which means they don't end up taking up some fights that many think they should take on. That sort of seems to be another flavor of the case that Edelman was making at The Atlantic. But as a longtime political strategist, should elected Dems, as you see it, be taking on every fight, even if they know it's one that they cannot win?
I mean, there's infinite fights in the world. I'm not suggesting anybody should take on every fight. There's too many. What I am suggesting is that the idea that, like, you can wait until the one that comes along that, oh, there's a 75% chance we'll win this. There's not a 75% chance we'll win anything. That's mm-hmm. not the situation we're in. There's a 100% chance we'll lose every fight we don't pick. So people mm-hmm. are going to have to engage in some fights that they think we'll probably lose. That's the only way we actually end up winning them. And sometimes you can gain ground while losing. Sometimes you can tell a useful public story while losing. And that's something that I do think the Democratic Party leadership of the last couple of decades, frankly, has not been very good about. I think they're afraid of looking weak if they lose, and I think sometimes you look more weak when you're unwilling to fight.
What would you like to see, finally, as a longtime political strategist, what would you advise Democratic leaders here to do better in their current fight against the excesses and dangers of the Trump era?
I would just say broadly, you know, a sentiment you see a lot from Democratic leaders in Congress is we can't really do much. We don't control Congress. We don't have any power legislatively. And that actually is true. I have a lot of sympathy for that. I wish they would take the next step and say to themselves, given that, how should our behavior change? Mm-hmm. How should we refocus our efforts on building a movement to oppose this? On picking some fights that, although we will lose, that nominee will can be confirmed, that law will pass, the act of opposing it can still have organizing value and agenda setting value and shifting the conversation value. But like, recognize that the answer isn't throw your hands up in the air. And there was a quote a couple weeks ago from a Democratic senator responding in frustration at critics who wanted them to do more by saying, like, sneeringly, what do they want us to do? Handcuff ourselves to a lamppost? And maybe.
Sure.
You know,
okay.
Like, understand that the history of change in America and deep, large-scale change in America, which is the type that we need right now, often does involve acts of civil disobedience. Uh-huh. And I'm not necessarily sure that this is the right moment when United States senators should be doing that kind of thing, but I do know it's not something we should be mocking. Because they don't have power to do anything legislatively. They're right about that. And so we should be looking for other solutions, other tactics, other strategies, and not mocking the concept of seeking other tactics and strategies.
Well considered, sir. Maybe they should just think about playing down on Cripple Creek at their rallies. Maybe that would help.
Never a bad idea.
That's never a bad idea. You're absolutely right. Jameson Fosier, a longtime political strategist, media critic, writer, and helped found the Critical Media Matters for America, where he served as executive vice president for many, many years. He's now the author of the Finding Gravity newsletter. You can find that newsletter at findinggravity.net, and you can find Jameson on the Blue Skies at Jameson Fosier. Jameson, really appreciate you joining us today, sir. Please feel better, and hope you don't mind if we give you a shout in the future.
Thank you so much for having me, Brad.
Thank you, brother. Okie dokie, then.
I thought he was
looking at me like you got something you want to say.
I do.
What do you want to say?
I think that he, Jameson, bringing up the idea that you have to fight, pick the thing that interests you and fight over that thing, regardless of what somebody else tells you is worth fighting over. Because it makes sense to me that if you stand firm, that's a muscle. Resistance is a muscle. If you don't fight for the First Amendment when it's easy, how are you going to be able to mount a serious fight when it gets really, really hard?
Good point. But of course, I can't stop thinking about the idea of handcuffing Chuck Schumer to a lamppost. So maybe that's just me. I don't, since you mentioned it, I can't get that out of my head. All right, quick break. We're back with Desi Doyen and the latest Green News Report straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Hey, by the way, just because we haven't spent too much time on it today, don't lose track of the fact that the destruction of the U.S. government is still underway today. With news from the New York Times that roughly 6,000 employees will be laid off at the IRS in the middle of tax season. I'm sure that'll work out fine. Hope you weren't counting on getting your tax return back a refund back anytime soon this year. Also of note to you, Desi Doyen, another round of firings are coming at FEMA, this time targeting employees who have worked on anti-discrimination issues, DEI, as the Republicans like to call it, and or climate change.
Yikes.
So if they worked on climate change at FEMA, they're out.
Yep. Stupid. It's so stupid.
Speaking of stupid, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report. It's not stupid.
The important part is freezing the assets.
Federal prosecutor resigns over improper Trump order to claw back EPA grants for clean energy. Fossil-fueled extreme weather has doubled the price of cocoa and coffee. Plus,
we are not subservient to a king or anyone else out of Washington.
Trump cancels New York City's successful first-in-the-nation congestion pricing.
And declares himself king. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
President Donald Trump tweeted, "Long live the king." I'm here to say New York hasn't labored under a king in over 250 years. We sure as hell are not going to start now.
Excellent, Governor Hochul. Have you checked with the king about that? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I guess we have to start here with coffee and cocoa. These are two of my favorite things.
Yes, the costs of climate change continue to mount, and it is now coming for your coffee and your chocolate.
Damn it.
A new analysis finds steep price spikes linked to extreme weather. Since 2022, cocoa prices have quadrupled and coffee prices have doubled, with yields hammered by a combination of excessive rainfall and high temperatures in producing regions.
I thought Donald Trump was going to fix all of this.
Yeah, he didn't.
Oh.
He's making it worse.
Oh.
The Trump administration's dismantling of the federal government is already degrading services at our already understaffed national parks. Trump's hiring freeze and purges of experienced critical park rangers and federal workers is already disrupting visitor services at the nation's most crowded parks and taken reservation systems offline. Experts warn that escalating extended disruptions will affect rural gateway communities that rely on park tourism revenue.
And people really do not like when the national parks are shut down. They really like their national parks.
Scientific research organizations are concerned that Trump's arbitrary firings of government scientists will cripple U.S. science research and global leadership in unrecoverable ways. The Trump White House forced the National Science Foundation, which funds vital scientific research, to fire 10% of its workforce. The Department of Homeland Security, FEMA's parent agency, issued a stop work order on all climate-related projects and a purge of all climate change terminology across the entire agency. At the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the head of the Food Safety Division has quit in protest over sweeping staff cuts that he says will hamper the agency's ability to protect public health. The Agriculture Department announced this week that it accidentally fired officials working to combat the spread of bird flu and is now working hard to try to rehire them.
Oops.
But the biggest news, the top federal criminal prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., resigned on Tuesday rather than comply with what she said were improper orders from the Trump administration to freeze the assets of climate-related grants approved by Congress and already allocated by the EPA. Veteran prosecutor Denise Chung also said she refused an order to open a criminal investigation into the grants, saying she had not yet found any evidence of criminality. The probe was intended to justify EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin's push to claw back roughly $20 billion in grants for climate resilience projects under the Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act. Zeldin's unsupported allegations were based on a deceptive video by a right-wing propaganda group that falsely portrayed the grants as illegal. And finally, Trump Transportation Secretary and former reality TV star Sean Duffy on Wednesday abruptly revoked approval of New York City's wildly successful congestion pricing toll on private vehicles entering Lower Manhattan. The revenue goes to fund the city's mass transit infrastructure. In just 1 month, congestion pricing dramatically reduced the city's notorious traffic. Car crashes and pedestrian injuries were cut in half. Lawsuits are already underway to reverse the decision. Here's New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul.
I don't care if you love congestion pricing or hate it. This is an attack on our sovereign identity, our independence from Washington. The next time you're stuck in traffic, the next time your train is delayed, the next time you're in a flooded station because infrastructure repairs were not made, I want you to think of this.
And think about this, Governor Hochul. The White House, in making this announcement, said, congestion pricing is dead. Manhattan and all of New York is saved. Long live the king. Along with an AI photo of Donald Trump wearing a crown. It came from the White House. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Here comes the king of clowns.
Wow. Just wow.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Wow, indeed.
I'm sorry, I'm out of words.
I know, I hear you. I feel you. Desi Doyen is our producer, and we are mighty grateful for you every day. Also grateful for our guest today, Jameson Fosier, and to all of you who spent a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download all of them since the beginning of time for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough when you stop on by to hit a donate button there. Sign up for a monthly subscription for any amount you like. It is greatly appreciated. It is very much needed, particularly now, to help us keep up this good fight on your public airwaves. We can only do it with your help. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And you will find me on the social medias, particularly Blue Sky, at The Brad Blog. But if you're really looking for fun, you'll find and follow Desi Doyen over there at Blue Sky and everywhere else. She is
at Green News Report. Please do come by and say hi.
There you go. To her, not me. Anyway, that's it. We're out of here. We'll see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Here I come, the king of clowns.